first Condensed Matter Young Scientist Conference.
Yeah.
So we'll have 9 talks this week, all of them by PhD students or postdocs.
Wow.
If I could be allowed. And our first talk is given by Miles Stadelmeier from University of California, Irvine. He did his PhD in Santa Barbara with Leon Valens, and now he's finishing postdoc in Stephen White's group.
So you said no old face allowed.
No faculty does allow.
What does mean?
No, only talks. So in the audience can have.
Sure.
but all invited speakers are under my.
All right. Thanks. It's thanks, Lucas. It's been really nice to be here. I've enjoyed my visits so far quite a lot. So my name is Miles, and I'm visiting from Irvine. And these are the collaborators I've done this project with so far. So Steve White's my advisor, and he's the creator of DMRG. And then Kieran is an expert in density functional theory, which will make up like a good part of the end of this talk. And then this is Lucas, his graduate student, who's really played an integral role in this project as well. And we're funded by Department of Energy, mainly. All right, so a quick summary. The idea is that we have this incredibly powerful tool called DMRG, which can basically just annihilate 1D systems. You can basically just give you the exact wave function in 1D systems. But it's actually not a magic black box that you have to get it to work. So the thing is, it hasn't been possible until recently to really use it effectively to study continuum models in 1D. But we've sort of, through a combination of tools and recent developments, we've been able to overcome that. And so we can study 1D continuum models with long-range interactions. Why are we interested in this? You might say, 1D, okay, that's not so interesting, or why do we need to go to the continuum? There's actually a lot of possible projects we can think about doing. I'll be talking about this one today, but one right away is that cold atom experiments, it's pretty easy for them to go into the 1D limit, or basically quasi-1D limit, and they know what Hamiltonian they have in essence, and they have lots of experimental tools to access the physics that they're seeing. So that would be a really nice, that's something we really would like to pursue, is making, basically quantitative comparisons to cold atom experiment. Another one that I'll mention a little bit later is that we can understand, often in strong correlation physics, we use lattice models, and there's some story or some words about how we get these lattice models, but it's not always so clear when these lattice models really apply. And sometimes they're pushed quite far out of their domain of applicability. So here we can actually construct these lattice models more or less exactly, and we can understand when various lattice models are appropriate. But then today I'll be talking about the 1D continuum as a laboratory for studying density functional theory. So what I mean is not to use density functional theory, but to actually study density functional theory itself as an object of study, because it's a very useful method in 3D. So I'll tell you more about that as we go on. But a quick outline, I'll give you some quick background on DMRG just to give you a flavor of how it works, and then explain to you what's new in DMRG that's enabled us to do 1D continuum calculations, then show you some exact results on charge gaps of atomic chains, and then explain to you how we can calculate exactly what DFT does to model these same band gaps and whether it succeeds or fails at capturing them in the Cohn-Sham picture. So. And let me emphasize that there's no approximations whatsoever in this talk. So everything I'll show you will be an exact result, even the DFT stuff. So when things don't match, that'll be an interesting question of why. So what is DMRG? So from my point of view, DMRG is kind of like a dream method numerically. It gives you almost everything you could ask for from a numerical method. You get essentially exact results, especially in these 1D models. And it's controlled, so it tells you how well it's working. It gives you an error bar, and if it's not working, it throws up a red flag, so you know to stop and maybe recalibrate. It scales linearly in 1D, at least for short-range interactions, and I'll explain what the deal is with long-range interactions. You get access to the ground state wave function, meaning you can, once you've done the calculation, you can calculate every kind of observables you want. That's not so trivial for other numerical methods. There's very nice extensions that can do finite temperature, real time. It's also recently we figured out how to parallelize DMRG, and I'll be publishing that soon. So the only weak spot of DMRG is that you can only do really 1D and sort of quasi-1D systems, although I have to say it's really becoming right now a very extremely useful method for 2D lattice models. So it's not that it fails in 2D, it's just you have to work a lot harder. So how does DMRG work? basically, you have some kind of representation of the many-body wave function on your computer, but you start out and it's not the right wave function. So what do? You say, okay, it would be too hard to just get the right wave function in one shot the way you do in exact diagonalization, say. So you freeze out most of the wave function in real space. So you set most of the wave function amplitudes fixed, and then you only have one region in real space where you're allowed to vary the wave function. And you use this frozen part of the wave function to project the Hamiltonian down into just this smaller Hilbert space near these sites. And then you just solve the Schrodinger equation exactly for the ground state in that small region in space. Then you take that improved piece of your wave function and essentially perform a singular value decomposition to cut it, and then either incorporate that into the left, to kind of grow the left region or grow the right region. And by doing so, you can shift the region that's frozen and now repeat and solve the Schrodinger equation exactly again in a nearby region in space. And so this generates a sweeping procedure where after you go back and forth and do this enough times, you find the true ground state. Let me show you just a movie of how this works. So this is one of these continuum systems that I'm going to be showing you more results on later. The idea is this is just a little toy calculation to give you a flavor. This isn't the exact V of X, but this is just a cartoon of it. It's just a single well in the middle. And we start the system with just two electrons. And they want to both sit in this well so they can lower their energy. But we intentionally put it in a really terrible starting state where neither one of them is in the well. Neither one of them is very spread out. And the up one is on the left, and the down one is on the right. And let's see how well DMRG does in overcoming this initial state. So this line shows you where the cut is in the system, where it's piecing together frozen parts of the wave function on the left and the right. And one thing that's interesting to notice is it doesn't just improve the wave function right at the line, but it also improves it further away, kind of within a correlation length or so of the system, if you can say that there's a correlation length here, because it's actually mixing many body states on the left and right halves of the system together, wherever the cut is. And it's also interesting to watch the energy go down as it searches for the ground state. And you can see the sweep, how many sweeps we've done up here. So you can see it was able to overcome the really bad initial state. And then it's able to still, even though it's already found the energy pretty accurately, you can just basically make arbitrarily finer and finer improvements to the energy simply by keeping, when you do this cut, you have to decide how many of the states you want to retain in order to make the method tractable.
Normally, if there is two particle interactions, there will be some kind of correlation both.
Oh, right. So oh, sorry. Yeah, these are interacting also. Mm-hmm.
They are interacting.
They are interacting. So, right. So there is some interaction cost, but it's still better for them to both be in the minimum and just spread out. Right. Right. So there would be some spin fluctuations as well in here, but those aren't visible. These are just plots of the spin densities. Mm-hmm. But it's a singlet, so they have to be the same, the two spin densities, right? So that's just to give you a flavor of what a DMRG calculation looks like. And that's about real time. I mean, actually, for that system, it would probably go a good bit faster, maybe four or five times faster than that. So they don't actually take too long. So for the bigger systems, though, they can take, you know, maybe more like 10, 20 hours for the ones I'll be showing you. So how do you use DMRG in the continuum? I just showed you a movie of one of these calculations. Well, there's one very interesting method that's been proposed just a couple years ago, and that is to actually take, I won't say a lot about this, but that's to take the wave function, the class of variational wave function that DMRG finds, which are known as matrix product states, and they basically look like just a product of matrices, and to take the continuum limit of this product. So instead of having a single matrix for every lattice site in your lattice model, you go to the continuum, and now you just have a function, a matrix that's parameterized by parameter x in real space. So if you want to know more about that, you can take a look at these papers. We haven't been using that approach. I've talked to some people implementing it, and it seems like there's some practical difficulties in making it work very well. So we've been taking a much more simple-minded approach, and this is the one we'll be using for the rest of the talk. And that's just simply to discretize. So it seems very simple, but there's some challenges there. But what do I mean? Just that we focusing, say, on just the kinetic energy term in a generic continuum Hamiltonian in 1D, the idea is that we simply just use some kind of discretization of our, we just use some kind of discretized derivative instead of a continuum derivative. So here I've just chosen kind of like a second order breakup of a second derivative. But actually we don't even have to make this choice. We could make other choices. We could use a fourth order breakup. There's other ones. But just for simplicity, we use the second order one. And you'll notice it looks like a hopping term, like in a Hubbard model. But it's not, that's really not the right way to think of it here, because these aren't lattice sites, these are grid sites. So these points just represent little bins in real space, and we can use as many or as few as we want. We could even use, say, more of them in regions where the density varies rapidly, though I won't do that here. And the idea is just to check that our results don't depend on the grid spacing A as we take A to be smaller and smaller. And this approach is used in both of these recent papers. So this is the kind of Hamiltonian we want to study in 1D, just sort of a very generic kind of real, sort of as realistic as we can write down, essentially. So we look at fermions with spin, and we have a standard kinetic energy term. We have a two-body interaction. And then this is our main parameter that we'll be tuning, is just the one-body potential V of X. So that's really our control knob on how we can access different phases or look at different physics. This is what it looks like in the grid. So there's that second order breakup of the kinetic energy. And then these are just the same looking terms, but now they live on grid points. And then the idea, again, is we just want to, as long as we can check that our results don't depend on this choice of A, we're in the continuum. That's the idea. And we have to choose some kind of model system to study. So for our interactions, just for simplicity, we're just going to look at exponential interactions in this talk, though I'll mention in a little bit how we can also do power law interactions. And then the kind of systems we're going to look at are 1D atom chains. So what do we mean by an atom here? Well, the electrons are real degrees of freedom, but our protons or our nuclei are just going to be wells. So we'll just take negative Z times the electron-electron interaction and flip it over, and that's going to be our quote atom. So they're just like little one-dimensional pseudo-atoms. And then the idea is that mainly we'll be tuning the distance between these atoms to see if we can get various types of ground states. And then because we'll use enough grid points to accurately represent a continuum density, when I show plots, most of the plots, I'll just leave off the grid points. All right, so this seems very simple and kind of elementary. So what's new here? Why hasn't DMRG just been used already on these systems? It's been around now for about 20 years. Well, they're not so easy actually to work with. There's two major challenges in working with these systems. So one is there's a very big computational cost for doing long-range interactions if they're not done the right way. I'll tell you how to do them the right way. And then there's also major issues with getting DMRG to converge. So DMRG works almost magically on sort of 1D lattice models, but when you apply it to these kind of grid models with a very small a, you can get very, very poor results unless you set up everything carefully.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why do you call this long range? Didn't you say it's an exponential spread?
Right. So here by long range, I just mean it's not finite range. I mean, it's sort of in principle. Right, but it has a length
anything
scale.
That is
absolutely, yeah.
Like, your cutoff potential is considered not long
absolutely
range.
Right. So I'm just using it to mean not finite range. But later I'll actually explain how we can also do power law interactions just as well. So for this, we were doing power law. I'll just go ahead and say we were doing power law calculations for a while, but then at some point we realized that the physics we're trying to look at right now, the stuff we're interested in that I'll be talking about later, wasn't really so sensitive to the type of interactions we were using. So we just for now, we're going back to exponential because it's technically easier for us. But
power
we can,
law would mean too long.
Really, any power law, we were doing a kind of regularized Coulomb, like a soft Coulomb. But we decided for now, we didn't really need that. But we are planning to put that back in later and see what effects it has. But it's sort of a future result. So we're actually getting to this point. What's the challenge with long-range interactions? So the conventional approach in DMRG is either to study lattice models where you just have finite range interactions, or to put in long-range interactions, just put in every possible pairwise interaction. And this actually works fairly well for some kind of lattice models, and you can do this with a cutoff. Like you can say, I'll put in every pairwise interaction up to some finite range, and then just increase this range incrementally until you see that your results are no longer very sensitive to that range. So that's a valid approach. The problem is we're on the grid. And so in the grid, we want to take as many grid points as we can get away with. Normally, DMRG scales linearly with the number of lattice sites, or in our case, grid points. But with this approach, the overall scaling would be n cubed because you have every pairwise interaction. So for us, we want to have something like 1,000 or so grid points for our largest finite size system. So this would be a huge disaster. This would just not work at all. So what can we do? So this will have to go by kind of fast. Sorry for those of you who aren't very familiar with ideas of matrix product states, but just to give you a flavor, after some theoretical work that's been done over the last few years, we now have a much better understanding of the kinds of wave functions that DMRG is generating when you do a calculation. And by analogy, you can also think of the Hamiltonian in the same way. And the idea is these wave functions look, like I said earlier, like products of matrices that connect up different finite range. They basically produce entanglement with an exponential decay across the system. It's like looks like a transfer matrix that carries quantum entanglement, essentially. So what do I mean? These can also be useful for representing Hamiltonians. And how does this work? The idea is that you can also factorize your Hamiltonian. Instead of writing it as a bunch of terms, you can actually write it as a product of matrices. So here, the idea is that I factorize the Hamiltonian as a product of operator-valued matrices. And if I set this lambda to be zero, actually what this would give me is just the next neighbor sigma z term in, say, the Ising model in 1D. And then I can just play this trick of putting an identity operator here in the diagonal with some base lambda. And when I do that, instead of just getting sigma z, I can get sigma z followed by an arbitrarily long string of these lambda times the identities, and then finally another sigma z somewhere arbitrarily far away. And you see that this is at a finite cost. All I have to do is just have little 3x3 matrices representing my Hamiltonian. So this actually is the same cost as doing DMRG on the Ising model. And I get long-range interactions or exponential interactions. So once I have that trick in my arsenal, I can also do I can do power law interactions, because the idea is now we always are studying some kind of finite size system. And on that finite size system, I can say I want to do power law interactions, and then I can just simply fit that power law to a sum of exponentials and just have multiple exponential decays making up my interaction. And often this works quite well. Recently I did a project with one of our R-cubed interactions, and it turns out you only need something like 5 exponentials to get extremely good fits. So this works very well in practice. Okay, so that issue is solved with that trick. So we can do long-range interactions and retain linear scaling in the system size or in the grid number of grid sites. Another major issue is when you're working with these continuum systems, there's many different energy scales at play. So one energy scale is the kinetic energy scale of the grid. And so you have this 1 over a squared multiplying your kinetic energy. And that the idea is you want to take A as small as it can be. Often we take it to be 0.1 or 0.05. So this is a very large energy in your bare Hamiltonian. Then at a different scale, you have density fluctuations. And then in the strongly correlated systems, like say if you think about going to this limit where it's well described by the Hubbard model, you also have effectively a Heisenberg J energy scale governing the spin fluctuations. So these can be many different orders of magnitude apart. So that can lead to major convergence issues for DMRG. Typically, when you're studying things like simple spin lattice models with DMRG, your limitation is how many states can I keep in DMRG, and that's typically what you're worrying about, and you have to keep maybe up to many thousands of these DMRG states to represent your wave function. But often you get the correct wave function in just 5 to 10 sweeps of DMRG, just going back and forth. But here, we don't need so many states. We can just get away often with, say, like 500 states or maybe 1,000, which is not that much for us. But the problem is that because of this energy scale issue, if we start with a poor initial state, we may need thousands and thousands of sweeps actually to find the ground state, which essentially means you won't really ever find it. So how do we work around this issue? How do we generate good initial states for the DMRG to use? The solution is to think about the physics down on the grid level. So what are we really doing? So we're representing the continuum by a bunch of these grid points. But really, on the level of the grid, it's a very, very low density system. So there's arbitrarily many of these points, but we want to work with some fixed number of total particles. So basically, the system is mostly empty on the grid level. Again, we're not thinking of these as sort of real atoms or anything like that. And so the idea is if we think about calculating just the reduced density matrix of a few of these sites, like here I just put a box around 4 sites, only the first few reduced density matrix eigenstates are really important, meaning they only have some kind of reasonable probability of being occupied. And there's many more that are there in principle, but don't add any weight into the ground state wave function. So that's the thinking. So somehow we'd like to only keep the first few and rotate into that basis of the important local density matrix eigenstates. How can we do this? We can think about applying some kind of rectangular unitaries. I mean, I called them isometries, and some people objected to that. But the idea is these are like truncated unitaries. So first we do a unitary transformation into this reduced density matrix basis, and then truncate only keeping the first few important ones. And you can represent them by these kind of tensors. That's what we want to do. And it turns out, actually, in practice, the best thing to do is to use just a 2-to-1 map. And that works well enough, surprisingly.
Why did they object?
I was talking to a mathematician, and they said isometries have a whole different meaning in mathematics. But I think this is the tensor network language usage. So, yeah. yeah, is. Something like, you know, a homomorphism with a, or something, it's some other kind of different meaning, but.
I mean, like a transformation of manifolds that preserve.
Yeah. So I think it goes through, right?
That's a linear algebra word, which has a definite meaning.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, that's what I thought too. Okay, so the idea is now, what does it look like if we repeat this scheme? So I just told you that a 2-to-1 map turns out to be, in practice, the simplest to do, and it works just as well. So the idea is that we want to think of finding these isometries that will truncate us down only to the best local basis to use, and then we want to repeat this some number of times. And so this naturally generates what's called a tree tensor network, except at the top, we have an MPS, because we started with a matrix product state. This is a bit technical, so if you're not following this is just for those who can. But the idea is our original wave function was stored as a matrix product state, then we iterated this RG scheme a couple of times. So it's just kind of interesting, you end up with this kind of hybrid of a matrix product state and tree tensor network state. And that's the kind of state we work with. But what's neat here is that you can optimize this kind of wave function with DMRG at each level. And I'll show you a picture of that in a second. So how are we actually calculating these isometries in practice? Well, there's a paper from about 7 years ago now that explains a very simple way how to do this if you already have the correct wave function. But for us, we either have sort of no guess for the correct wave function or a very poor one. So what we're doing in practice is actually just making up these isometries. So the optimal isometry may, if you think about running these labels, the states here may have some kind of structure to them. Like this might be on the edge of some hill in the density where there's some variation in the density profile. So there might be some slope or something. But we're just taking simply what we're calling flat maps, where if you think of these as orbitals on these two sites, it's just simply a flat orbital with each different spin. And so that seems like a really bad guess, but the idea is that this is so fine-grained, we're always going 2-to-1, 2-to-1, that we start at the top and make some really poor initial state and make this tree consisting only of these flat maps. And then as we descend each level, our density will have all these notches in it, but DMRG can very quickly clean up all these notches, and then we can descend down to the next level. And every time we drop a level and double our number of sites, we have all these errors from the flat map guess, but then DMRG can quickly take care of those. And we get what we want, which is a nice initial state. So just a demonstration of what this looks like. So the idea is we want to apply this to a system with 40 electrons and 40 of these atomic wells. So we simply start with an initial state, which is just position eigenstates, which is a horrible initial state because that pays this huge grid kinetic energy cost, which is very unphysical. And we just put these 40 particles down. And then we RG them up, I think it's 4 levels with these flat maps. And it looks the same because they're just these delta function kind of initial states. But then DMRG can work extremely well in the top layer because we've effectively reduced the grid spacing. And so all the energy scales are brought to be more equal to each other. And so DMRG can work extremely well with this coarse grid spacing and get some kind of initial state that's sort of reasonable and has a reasonable energy. Then we can map down through the flat maps and double our number of grid points, run a few more DMRG sweeps again, and each time we're doubling the number of grid points, and it lets DMRG gradually find the correct ground state without having to deal with this very, very high grid kinetic energy scale. And finally, we get down to our bare grid that we started on, and we've initialized the DMRG properly. Okay, so that was all the technical parts about why is doing DMRG in the continuum hard? But then I showed you that with these combination of tools, we can actually make it work. And with those tools, it's actually now works extremely well, and we've been exploring a wide range of continuum 1D systems to see what kind of interesting physics we can investigate. So this is a work in progress. But so now what we've been interested in is looking at different kinds of charge gaps in these 1D atom chains. So we're going back and just revisiting some old stories in physics, but we have an eye to DFT. So in density functional theory, gaps are a big deal, and calculating charge gaps is a big challenge for density functional theory practitioners. So what's the simplest system we can make in our little pseudo-atom chain scheme? Well, the simplest system is just to make a bunch of pseudo-hydrogen atoms, where we just make a bunch of individual wells stretched by a bond length B, and put a single electron in each well, and then let the system relax and find the ground state. So what do these systems look like? So the idea is that our tuning parameter is just the spacing of these wells. So the wells here are spaced by a distance of 1 in these units and to start with. And this system has a very small gap. It's in the metallic limit. And you can see that there's actually only 20 bumps in the density. There's this kind of 2kF to 4kF crossover that some of you may have heard of. So this is a kind of metallic limit. And then we stretch the wells out, and now you start to see this kind of 4kF type of oscillation in the density. And then finally, as we stretch more and more, we reach basically the atomic limit, where we just have almost like a product state of independent hydrogen atoms. How do we calculate the charge gaps of each system? Well, we actually have to do three different ground state calculations. So first, we do the calculation for the neutral system, where we just have one particle in each well, and it's half spin up, half spin down. And then we also add a particle to the system, calculate the ground state energy, or sorry, remove a particle, and then also add a particle. These are the spin densities and total charge density. And then calculate the charge gap this way. So you can think of this as a discretized second derivative, if you like, or it's also, if you've heard of this I minus A formula in chemistry for calculating the charge gap, it's also that. And so then we have to do this. I just showed you some 40 atom systems. We have to do this going up to at least 80 atoms in many cases. So very long calculations, often involving thousands of these grid sites, and extrapolate these charge gaps to the thermodynamic limit. And so we see that for smaller bond lengths, we see that the gaps are extrapolating nearly almost to zero, but then it seems like a gap is opening. And then as we go to much larger stretching, we get very large finite charge gaps. And so then what does this look like when we put it all together? There's the final result. So this is these are the exact charge gaps of these hydrogen chains in the thermodynamic limit. And we can see that this actually resembles qualitatively some properties of the 1D Hubbard model, although this is a much more realistic Hamiltonian than just the Hubbard model. But it's very similar in that it has this exponential opening of the gap here in these small gap systems. And then for the large gap strongly correlated systems, the gap goes linearly. All right, so next we were thinking of what's a system that has a rather different kind of charge gap, meaning that the system I just showed you is a Mott insulator because you have one electron per unit cell. So we were also, we'd like to see a band insulator. So one way to get this is to simply make our system out of little H2 molecules. So we just fix a pair of wells at some fixed distance, which happens to be the equilibrium bond distance for just a little H2 and 1D. And then our tuning parameter is the distance between these pairs. So we stretch out these little molecules. And the idea is now there's two electrons per unit cell. So we expect this to be more of a band insulator. And indeed, well, here's the plots of the densities of the ground states, starting from the smaller bond spacings up to the larger. And we repeat the extrapolations and the calculation, and we see indeed a gap opens right away. So now let's turn to density functional theory, and we'll try to see how does density functional theory, which in practice rests on a non-interacting picture, is it able to calculate these charge, to capture these charge gaps, and what are some of the challenges going forward in trying to make better functionals, and what can you really say? So first, some DFT background. I thought it might be interesting to explain to everybody some of the basics. So density functional theory is really a huge method in our field. It's one of the most practical, widely used methods. It can deal directly with 3D and systems of huge complexity. And this is kind of a fun plot. It shows the number of DFT citations in KILA papers since about 1990. And this is when the Nobel Prize went to Walter Cohn. And then these colors represent the number of papers referencing two of the most widely used functionals. Both are called GGAs. This one's BBE and then B3-LIP. These are the two most widely used. So what is density functional theory? Well, it actually has exact foundations. It's really a rewriting of quantum mechanics, at least for a certain class of systems, but using the density and not the wave function as the basic variable. So the idea is instead of thinking of the energy as coming from the wave function, you think of an energy functional that depends on the density in some kind of arbitrary way. So that here, functional essentially just means that the dependence could be sort of arbitrarily complicated or long range or nonlinear or whatever you like. So that's really what people mean by functional in this case. But the thing is, this seems kind of hopeless because it's just some kind of formal rewriting, but it actually leads to incredibly useful approximations. And so Kiran likes to call it one of the greatest free lunches ever, because it's like a huge shortcut in computer time, and you're able to get remarkably good results on very realistic systems. And so one reason to care about DFT is this is often really where condensed matter theory really meets the real world. It's where the rubber meets the road. And so here I'm just showing a recent paper by Jason Alessia with some collaborators at UC Irvine, and I think also in Canada, who were looking at a scheme for opening up strong, larger bulk gaps in graphene to enhance the topological insulating phase. And the idea was to put ADA atoms on the surface of graphene. And then through these density functional theory calculations, they were able to see that it made the bulk gap more robust. And this is the topological bulk gap. So it's actually very useful even for investigating topological physics, as long as it's of a weakly correlated type. So what is this rigorous foundation that DFT rests upon? What do people mean when they say that it's an exact theory? The idea is that you're thinking of a certain class of Hamiltonians where your kinetic energy is of a fixed type and your interactions are of a fixed type. And then really the thing you're varying is this V of X. That's why we're doing the same kind of scheme in our 1D calculations. This is really your control knob. And then, okay, it's very straightforward to observe that if you choose a certain V of X, you get a certain ground state wave function. Here I'm glossing over issues of degeneracy. And then from that ground state wave function, you get a ground state density. Okay, so we believe that these arrows go this way. But the surprising fact is that the arrows also go the other way. So Hohenberg and Cohn showed, and Levy and Lieb showed more rigorously, that if you have a certain density, it could only have come from one ground state and from one V of X. So there's really only one V of X that could have given you that density. And again, that's for a fixed kind of type of kinetic energy and interactions. And then thereby, you can also follow the arrows, and you can say that for a given density, there's only really one wave function it could have come from, maybe up to a phase factor. And so then the idea is that really everything is a function of the density, because you start from the density, you go to the wave function, and then you get everything. So that's the idea. But this is a very formal statement, of course. So how do you use DFT in practice? Well, all real practical DFT approximations currently in use use the so-called Cohn-Sham scheme. It's not an approximation, it's just a scheme for working with this theorem, making it more useful. So the idea is that Hohenberg-Cohn, as I said, assumes that the interactions are of a fixed type. So you can find there's a loophole already, which is that what if I consider two different kinds of Hamiltonians? One is an interacting class, one is a non-interacting class, or the non-interacting class. The idea is now I can apply the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem twice. So I can say, give me a density, I don't have to know where it came from, and there must be only one potential V of X that can give that density. But in this other class, there's a different potential in the non-interacting class that also gives that density. So the idea is there's two potentials corresponding to these two different classes of interactions being interacting and non-interacting that both give the same density. And so then the nomenclature is, this is our original interacting system, and this is what's called the Cohn-Sham system. And the key thing to notice is this is a unique, well-defined thing. So people in practice will use additional approximations, but there really is only one Cohn-Sham system if it exists. That's the idea. And of course, this is useful because now we can try to find this thing, and once we do, it's easy to work with. And so now what's neat is that in our 1D continuum setup with DMRG, we can actually calculate the exact Cohn-Sham potential. So the DMRG does the heavy lifting. We start with a V of X, which defines our interacting system. We get a interacting ground state density. And then once we have that density, it's relatively straightforward to construct the Cohn-Sham system. So now we have this toolbox where we can actually open the lid on DFT and carry out DFT exactly in a fairly realistic setup. The only thing that's not realistic is that we're in 1D, but you have to give up something if you want to study it exactly.
Why do you need DFT once you have the exact function?
Right, you don't, but that's the point of benchmarking and studying it. So exactly, so we need DFT in 3D and we need it to work for strongly correlated systems. And so in 1D, we can solve strongly correlated systems, and then we can really take apart DFT. We can break it all the way down to all of its components. We can break out each separate. Later, there's these other parts, you know, the separate energy components, the Cohn-Sham potential. We can apply all the various approximations that are standard in the field.
But is then the point of this project to be able to say something about how well DFT works in 1D?
Yes. Well, partly. I mean, there actually are some interesting applications of DFT directly in 1D. To tunneling experiments.
But could you access those settings, those systems directly with DMRG?
Not always. Sometimes, but then sometimes even though our models are realistic, they have aspects of realism, they're still not terribly complicated. I mean, there's not so many particles, so we don't have, real core electrons. you know, so there could still be lots of complications. For instance, people use DMRG in quantum chemistry, and they might study a polymer, but there you can have very, very large quantum chemical basis sets, and there's no real natural ordering of them in a 1D way, and so it can be quite challenging. But still, the physics is sort of essentially 1D, and so if we can get DFT working better, then it could be, it can easily handle those complicated molecules and things.
And so one of the goals of this project then is to get DFT to work better?
In 1D and in 3D. Both. So, but in 1D for these systems, the point is that we don't need it because we can solve them. But that's, so it's a sort of a flipped around thing. We're not studying, I mean, it's, I don't want to say we're not studying physics, because I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of the talk all the other, you know, physics we are already beginning to look at as well with this scheme. This is just one of the projects we have going with this technology. But in a sense, we're not studying physics, we're studying DFT in this component of the project. Right.
And what do you expect to learn that would be useful for DFT in the future?
I'll show you some things, but we have lots of ideas. So what I'm going to tell you just in the remaining slides is about whether it's fair to look at the Cohn-Chan band gap and treat that as anything having to do with the real gap. And that's something that's been confusing to the whole DFT field for quite a while. But we also have imminent plans to apply all the different DFT approximate functionals, like LDA and PBE. But then there's also new functionals coming out, and that we'd like to try those. There's people who believe these new functionals should do various things better, but it's hard for those people to check whether their ideas really work. And so we have a whole nice framework where they can try it out. So, that's some of the examples.
So in 3D, people are looking for exact function. I mean, in 1D, you have discovered it.
We have it. Yeah, that's an interesting point. So I wish I had more time to get into that part of the story. We actually have a separate paper where we're actually describing what does it mean to have the exact functional? And we're sort of proving and exploring various properties of it, because we do have it. This doesn't quite amount to the exact functional, but this is almost what you need. So on this slide, the idea is we can construct, this blue curve is the non-interacting potential that gives you the same density without interactions that the black potential gives you with interactions. That's almost what you need to say you have the exact functional, but there's really one more ingredient, which we also have, which is you need to be able to, if I just gave you this green curve, and neither of these potentials, neither the black nor the blue, and you don't know how I got this green curve, I would have to be able to construct both the blue potential, which is easy, non-interacting, and the black potential. And that's called doing an interacting inversion. So basically running that arrow backwards, where you go from density to potential, but with interactions. And that's
so
tough.
So you give that N of X, and then also give the two-body interaction, and then you get this. Yeah.
And that's hard, because essentially you have to solve many interacting systems over and over in somewhat of a search algorithm to try to adjust this black curve until you obtain the target density that you were handed. And so the idea is that you are the black box, DMRG becomes the black box, and you give it an N and it gives you a V, and it has to solve lots and lots of interacting systems. So that's very time consuming, and it's not at all practical. But we're doing it because we want to understand basic facts about this functional. So it's interesting because people in the field talk about the functional as if it's some formula you could imagine writing down. You can think, oh, you know, E of N equals N squared of N or something plus, you know. But it's a bit of just that's not really the right idea in a sense. I mean, really, there is the exact functional, but Mike, this is the exact functional. I mean, this computer is the exact functional. So the exact functional is an algorithm in some sense, not a formula. You know, I mean, maybe I wouldn't maybe overstress that because people have written down very nice approximations, but it's sort of a helpful way of thinking.
Like you're saying, maybe in concrete terms, like there's no simple like representation of the functional,
right,
or something like that.
Well, there's no reason to expect that there should be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
it's just a formal. It's a formal one-to-one correspondence between a bunch of things.
And, right.
Yeah. So.
So in 3D, people started with Thomas Fermi approximation, and then.
Right, exactly. So you could probably write down the first few terms in this so-called exact formula. It might look like Thomas Fermi, and then plus some things, but to try to do that for every system strongly correlated, you know, very stretched atomic limit systems, it might be a fool's errand. So
in 1D you could do it.
But in 1D we just do it directly, essentially. We just do it with computer power. So we just compute it point for point as needed on the fly. That's the idea. So we're actually carrying out full Cohn-Chan iterative calculations with the exact functional this way. That's not what I'm talking about here, but that's something else we're doing. So the idea is it's sort of pedagogical, and we're also trying to really go after exact questions about DFT, questions of principle questions of approximations in practice. So how do we how did we get this blue curve? How did we construct this thing? It's pretty straightforward. So we had some interacting, we had some density that was our target density, which we either I could have just given to you or we could get from some interacting calculation. And we start with that density and we just guess some initial potential and solve it with, without interactions and see what we get. We compare the two densities, they won't be equal, and then we make an update. So we attempt to reduce the difference between them somehow. So you can do the simplest thing is just to say, okay, if the density is too big, then raise the potential and push the particles away, or too small, lower it. We actually now have a more sophisticated method, which I don't have time to get into, but the point is it's just a black box. So here's the initial guess potential, and then we just go through these iterations of updating it. Each time solving a non-interacting system, the red curve is the current best density that we have until it matches our target density. So that's what one of these inversions, so-called inversions, looks like, where we construct a potential without interactions. And we can do this also with interactions as well. So now let's get more a little bit more into DFT and what do people mean when they talk about it. So the idea is that that blue curve I just showed you, that's the Cohn-Sham potential. That's the non-interacting potential that gives you the interacting density. So in practice, for the purpose of approximations, people just choose to divide this up formally this way. They say, well, let's say that potential is equal to the original one, the interacting one, plus something, which is called the Hartree exchange correlation potential. But this is really the definition of this thing. So that's all it is. So you should just think of this as that minus that. And what this affords you is it gives you a mean field-like picture of what's going on in DFT. So originally we just had kinetic energy, no interactions, that's the Cohn-Sham scheme, plus the Cohn-Sham potential. We break it up and we see that now it looks like the original Hamiltonian, except the interactions are replaced by another one-body potential. So that's just mean field theory in structure. But it's not so obvious that it's really mean field theory. So the thing is, this is a question I had for a while, and I think I finally come to an answer that I like. Is DFT a mean field theory? Basically, I think the real answer is no. But in a way, in practice, it could be yes. So no, because DFT really gives you the exact ground state density if it's carried out without approximations, and energy. So there really is a functional that gives you the energy. There really is a functional that gives you the density. And the idea is, so the point is, it's interesting, there really is a VXC that's like the correct one. But in practice, people ask for more. They want more than just the density and the energy, although those are useful. They look at the band structure that arises from this Cohn-Sham potential, and they treat it as having some meaning. But from some point of view, all it's really doing is that the only thing that has meaning is the tent, and the band structure is like the tent poles, and you're just moving around the tent poles as you turn off the interaction. But you're not supposed to look at where the poles are. They're just there to hold the tent up. That's kind of the picture. So are they asking for too much? That's a question. So now this is the only approximation in this talk is simply, this is a kind of approximation to look at the band structure. It's not guaranteed to be at all a sensible thing to do, but people do it. And also, again, to the question of is DFT a mean field theory, another difference is in some versions of mean field theory, there may not really exist a mean field that reproduces properties of the original exact interacting system, but in DFT there is. There's always exists, whether you can find it or not, there's always a VHXC that will give you the original interacting density. It may just be hard to find. So now, just a little beginning of an application. This is something that we have going in progress. So how justified is this procedure? So this is now a kind of approximation of saying, let's go to this Cohn-Sham system and treat its band structure as having something to do with the interacting system, in particular, the gap. So in the real system, what are you supposed to do in DFT? You're supposed to calculate the charge gap the way we're calculating it in DMRG. You're supposed to do three calculations. You're supposed to look at the neutral system energy, which in principle you can get to arbitrary accuracy in DFT. And you're supposed to look at the energy of the systems where you add or remove a particle. So three calculations. But for technical reasons and in practice, mostly having to do with finite size effects, people just do one calculation. They just calculate the neutral system and do this Cohn-Sham scheme and get a non-interacting system that supports it, and then look at the band structure and try to read off the charge gap. This is what is done most of the time in practice. So when people say, But just to emphasize, that is an approximation of a type. That's just some procedure you do, but it's not guaranteed to mean anything. So let's go back now and look at these exact gaps that we obtained for our two kinds of atom chains and see how well this plays out. So again, the idea is we want to look at all these systems where we vary the bond length, spacing out these wells, and we see the gap opening become very large. And then for each one of them, obtain the exact Cohen-Chain potential. That's this blue potential. This is actually the exact one here. And then this is just a cartoon now on the left. Calculate its energy, the single particle energies, and just read off the band gap of that system. And does that gap have anything to do with the real gap? So first, let's look at our Mott insulators. So this is, again, these single hydrogen chains. And they're Mott insulators because we have one electron per unit cell, and yet there's a gap. So we know there's a very large gap that opens. What does the Cohen-Chain band gap look like? That's what it looks like. So it actually is 100% failure. The Cohen-Chain band gap is actually zero across
that's
the entire system.
DMP right. will not give you Mott gap.
It will not give you the Mott gap. So the thing is, exactly, and the next slide is to say, this shouldn't surprise you if you've sort of sat down and thought about it for a minute. But this is glossed over quite a lot in DFT. People ask this question all the time of how well should it work for Mott insulators, and
so they
put
LDA plus U.
Right. Yeah, that's actually something we have kind of right in the works we're going to be doing soon. Right, so the idea is, though, here, just in the simplest scheme, the point is right. So these are Mott insulators in the strictest sense, one electron per unit cell. So any kind of non-interacting picture of this that gives you the same density has to have a zero gap, essentially. And that's the idea. So this gives you a nice meaning to when people say words like, turn off interactions, how do you really turn them off? Well, in this picture, the idea is you turn them off by constructing the Cohen-Chain system. So that's kind of a nice way to sort of give a little bit more precise meaning to this idea of turning off interactions. So this isn't a failure of DFT, that's the point. It's just, it has to be this way. So that's just that's sort of a warning call to anybody trying to use DFT to get a gap that way. But it's not totally doomed to failure. I mean, if we look at a system that has a somewhat of a band gap type of gap, so here we had a system where there's a full band, and then we add interactions to it, we can ask a more interesting question, which is, okay, so now we expect there could be a Cohen-Chain gap, but nobody has ever seen how really, if you ever got the exact one, what percent of the real gap is it? That's never actually been calculated for an extended system, extended meaning in the thermodynamic limit. So
often it's about 30% wrong. Even this band gap, in the standard DFT, the error is about 30%.
Yeah, often it's like, right, often it's closer to that. So here again is the exact gap for these chains of H2 molecules. And then we, again, for each one, construct this non-interacting system, read off its band gap, and that's the result we get. So it's actually much larger than 30%, but it's still a far cry from the full thing, especially in the larger stretching when they're really far apart and this molecular limit.
But the result is a dark. That's the exact result.
That's the exact result. So that's the final story. That's the whole thing. So that's there's no more improving on that in the sense of this idea of reading off the band gap. So that's what's kind of our luxury here in this 1D setup, is that these are the exact thermodynamic limit band gap, exact gaps, and exact thermodynamic limit Cohen-Chain band gaps. That's the final story. So the point is that is a hard limit on density functional theory. That's as good of a gap as you will ever get for this class of systems in 1D. But that's not to mean DFT is doomed. The point is you're not supposed to get the gap that way. But that's what people are doing all the time. So the thing is, this problem can't just be fixed by better approximations, because I just showed you the true Cohen-Chain band gaps. That's just an inherent issue with that procedure. That procedure itself is a type of approximation. So there is a name for this piece that's missing. It's called the derivative discontinuity, and I won't have enough time to go way into that. But in fact, most approximations currently in use, especially the LDA and these GGAs, just do not have this in them. For extended systems, let's say, meaning in thermodynamic limit systems. And that's explained in this paper from 82. So the message here is that to ever have a chance of getting the real gap, you have to have a new functional. And there are ones in the works. There's papers recently about that, which incorporate this effect. All right, so now just to go away from DFT for a second or into some other applications, what are some future directions we'd like to pursue with this technology? We have a number of ideas, just to give you a flavor. So gaps are one example where the exact Cohen-Chain system fails to reproduce the real properties of the system. So gaps are no-go in that idea. But what about transport? It's very common. In fact, in DFT parlance, they actually call this the standard model, where you take the exact one-body Green function that you would like to know to calculate transport properties, and you simply say, well, that's too hard to get. Let's just do the Cohen-Chain system, the non-interacting system, and use its Green function. So why is that justified? I don't know, but people do it. And so what's surprising is that actually there's a recent result that if you do this in 1D on the single impurity Anderson model, you actually do get the exact transport. So if you just simply use the non-interacting system, the exact one, you actually get the same transport properties as if you use the correct interacting green function. And there's a way to understand this in terms of a sum rule, but that's for this very special model where you have this single impurity and it's just like a single lattice defect. So what we'd like to do is move away from that very singular limit and look at a whole general class of models in 1D with you know, further range interactions and in the continuum and see to what extent does this result hold. To what extent do you actually get the exact tunneling behavior from this non-interacting system, which is kind of a nice thing to know. And this isn't anywhere in the theorems of DFT, but somehow it just comes out in 1D. Another thing, now this is not related to DFT anymore. Another application that we're currently pursuing is to go back to this old story of the Hubbard model, where you construct it by thinking of having some kind of Vanier orbitals, and then you do a change of basis into this, maybe into just a single lowest Hubbard band, and then the idea is that you somehow could, there's some choice of these Hubbard parameters that will represent your continuum physics. But that's usually not carried out exactly. Usually there's some approximation along the way. Here we can actually carry that whole story out exactly at every step up until you start throwing away certain lattice parameters. And so it'd be interesting to do this construction and see exactly in different regimes which lattice parameters do you really need. Is it enough just to have the Hubbard U? Do you also need second neighbor repulsion? Do you need further neighbor hopping? All these questions. And then here's just some pictures of some Vanier functions I calculated, because we can actually get the exact one-body green function for all of our ground states in DMRG, and then diagonalize and construct localized.
This Vanier function is for mod insulator or for band insulator?
These are for the mod insulator system.
They are blocked.
Yeah.
So the tail depends on the gap.
Right. Exactly. So the tail here, we see it sort of has a much slower decay, and there's lots of oscillations which give you a much smaller U. We can never really turn interactions off. Like, we can never get a U of zero. We can get a very small U because of all these oscillations. And then you see as this B is that stretching of the atoms, and we can, and then we see we have very localized.
In fact, for U equal to zero, it should be a power of R. The Vanier function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you would expect. So, right. So then we have, and not only can we construct these Vanier orbitals from the one-body Green's function, it's interesting to do now what DFT people do, which is they don't have the one-body Green function of the exact system, but they do have a cone-cham system. Either we can do the exact one, or we can do like the LDA cone-cham system and get its Vanier orbitals, and we can compare the lattice models you would get, because this is what people do to begin DMFT calculations. They have to get lattice parameters out of sort of LDA calculations and things. So we can do all those things. Even those tensor networks I mentioned earlier, these tree tensor networks, if you think about RGing all the way until you get to sort of a Hubbard limit where you have one lattice site per original atom of the system, you can ask, if I only occupy that one site, what orbital does that correspond to back on the grid? Or you could even look at the MPO Hamiltonian that you've constructed by using the correct maps going all the way up. So there's some interesting questions there about really how to construct a lattice model. And then many more things we can explore. So we can explore other DFT approximations, LDA plus U. We can even do exact cone-cham plus U. We can turn on finite temperature in the continuum, and lots of interesting questions there. And then moving away from DFT, we can compare directly to cold atom experiments and so on and so forth. So we're very excited about all of these projects. Thanks.
Questions?
In three dimension, often one of the complaints is that LDA is not able to take care of long-range Coulomb interaction.
Mm.
That is the reason for the gap.
I think I know what you mean, like the decay of the LDA potential, the cone-cham potential is too fast, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
So, whereas in your case, mm-hmm. you're basically studying short-range interaction.
Yes.
And already you see dramatic difference between LDA.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I wonder.
My impression was that the big failure of LDA for gaps is this thing called delocalization error. And the idea is that really the exact functional has a total view of the density. It takes the whole density in, and it can read any part, it can use any part of it needs to. Whereas LDA is like looking at the density through a delta function. It's just that you only see a local cut, like a local piece. And so if I calculate the gap in the correct way, where I add a particle or remove a particle to the whole system, I add a particle, that extra density spreads out over the whole system. And the local density only changes, you know, by an arbitrarily small amount.
As you were saying, it's not to do with the range of...
Right. So the idea is, I believe it's actually, you can prove that the, I mean, this is I'd have to check this, but I believe you can even prove that if you do this three energy calculation of the gap, this is called fundamental gap in the DFT literature, that that actually for the LDA reduces just to the Cohn-Sham gap. That only the only part that remains due to the LDA approximation is just the Cohn-Sham gap. So that so LDA is sort of essentially doomed for mod insulators because of for you know getting the gap for that reason. So that's some of the insight that we're hoping to really shed light on. Because often there have been some, let me say, there have been some exact DFT calculations of this type, model calculations in 3D, which have the advantage of being in 3D, but people can only do like one atom or something. So here are the ideas we can really, we can do, or maybe a few atoms, but we can do really, you know, a whole class of many different kinds of many-body extended systems, you know, infinite systems in 1D. So we can really ask and answer questions having to do with how to use DFT in condensed matter, not just in quantum chemistry.
So that means to the extent that you can do DMRG, let's say, on a strip, you will be confident about the gap that you get.
Oh, trying to push into 2D or something. Well, I mean, so we do have some ideas of pushing, not really into 2D, but we could enrich our systems, maybe do two wires or something, two continuum wires. That's probably almost to the limit of what we would do and stay in the continuum. So the message we were selling, because I gave a similar talk to a more DFT audience at March meeting, and the message there was, you have to give up something. If you want exactness and you want to implement the entire DFT formalism from top to bottom, you can't do that and be in the continuum and have long-range interactions and be in 3D, because then physics would just be over, right? So so if anyone's attacking us on that, they're basically saying, you can't solve all of physics, you know, so it's not really fair. So what we're saying is we've got everything, and we've got you know, almost everything. The only thing we don't have is sort of, you know, very complicated atoms, atomic orbitals. We have basically everything except 3D, you know. So the idea is you have to give up something. And so we think for, the point is DFT has very little content on the lattice. If you're doing, there are these DFT approximations that live on the Hubbard model kind of lattice, that setup. But it's a very different kind of thing there, because the idea of DFT is you fix your interactions and then you just change your V of X. But on the lattice, your interactions are also changing. U is not really a fundamental thing anymore. It comes from the underlying physics. And so it's just a whole different thing. So the point is here, this is really where DFT lives in the continuum. So that we're saying that's the important part to keep, and we have to give up 3D.
Yeah, I mean, you say you have everything, but what about excited states? I mean,
oh, sure. Yeah. Right. So, for the DMRG side, not a problem. We can get low-lying excited states. There's sort of a number of standard ways.
Can you estimate the rate at which the system relaxes or something like that?
Sure. Well, you mean relaxes in
from an excited state to the ground state?
That's harder. We can probably do it. So there are nice methods for doing real time in DMRG. There probably would be some challenges for these continuum systems. They have lots of degrees of freedom, but the entanglement is not that much worse than the corresponding Hubbard model, because it really is coming from the particles, not the, you know, most of these sites are empty. They're just there kind of bystanders for a lot of the physics. So, right. So that in principle, none of these things are problems, but just as there were certain challenges in even just doing the ground state calculations, there would be challenges. But I think they're all surmountable. I mean, they're just interesting technical challenges to look at.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Is that time for a question?
Yeah, you have a question.
Sure. So let's see. Did I get it right that you started explaining how to get to the continuum? And then the second part, DFT, I mean, what you do is DMRG. Using the algorithm you have described before. Mm-hmm. So in that algorithm, you have an RG transformation where you go from large length scales, which you optimize the MPS initially to get the large
properties.
So and then you keep refining with prefabricated transformations, which you hope you got roughly okay. And not, if you didn't get them right, it's okay because through optimization, So do you intend to go back and, you know, back and forth between the scales?
I've tried that and I've thought about that quite a bit, but I've been surprised how difficult that has been. I mean, so one thing that could be missing is simply that it's this tree and not a Mira. So it seems like it would be very natural to put in these disentanglers to control, because as you go back up now, there's some bonds that you never attach a gate to.
Right.
And so that's one issue. So, um, So in some sense, you don't gain as much. What I've really found, all the ways I've tried different schemes for sort of moving up and down in the levels, starting again from the bottom and going up. I mean, of course, if I really get a very nice ground state, it's easy just to construct these maps and everything works fine. But if I sort of start with a poor wave function, often what happens is, let's say the spin densities aren't the same, but my ground state's really a singlet, so they should be. Then these maps have that frozen into them somehow. And then when I'm doing the optimization over here, it's not correct over there, and it's really, and it somehow seems to have a very hard time overcoming that.
So you find that going from the top, from large length scales to small length scales is best.
Mm-hmm.
But that requires that, you know, you have to introduce initial maps.
It does, but it turns out that it really almost doesn't matter what you choose. That's why this 2-to-1 really works.
Is that because it's low density, or is that due to particular?
I think it's just because basically you're sort of working in this limit where you have as many grid sites as you can possibly do, and so you're only making an error over a very tiny length scale in the system. And so it's just because the density, the variation in the density, the final wave function is very slow on that scale.
Right.
So it might be some little angle, and you were just replacing that with a flat thing instead of a little curved thing. But it's just basically the idea that, you know, that the derivative is always a good approximation to the slope of any curve locally. It's just, you know, basically, it's just that working for us, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
More questions? That's my class again.